Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome to Huff Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
I'm Grace Seegers.
And I'm Haley Bird Wilt.
And we are back with you to talk about Skeleton Crew, the latest live-action TV show from Star Wars, aired in December and into January, wrapped up a few weeks ago in mid-January. So we've got a lot to cover. This was a show that was packed with a lot of fun stuff and a lot of interesting stuff that expanded the Star Wars lore, but also told a really fun down-to-earth story set in the galaxy far, far away. So I thought maybe to start things off, before we get into the details, we could talk a little bit about this, the tone of the show, and how it in my opinion, kind of brings a fresh approach to Star Wars, showing us the universe in a way that we haven't seen it before. We see these grand adventures with the Jedi all the time, and these dogfights with X-Wings and TIE fighters. This was something different. This was something that showed us that there are a lot of just regular folks out there in Star Wars, including people who see the Jedi in much the same way that we do. They're out there having fake lightsaber duels and playing with little action figures just like we are. And they are also in the middle of the story, and that unfolds in a really cool way throughout the 8 episodes that we have here. Grace, maybe we could start with you. When you went into this, what was your expectation for what we were going to see from the tone of the show, and how did it either kind of play out in the way you expected or maybe surprise you?
So I went in with pretty much no expectations. I've been kind of let down by Star Wars shows in the recent past, as we have discussed on this very podcast. So I really barely knew anything about Skeleton Crew. Like, I knew it was about kids. I knew there was Jude Law. But I really had no further knowledge or expectations. I certainly wasn't expecting to love it as much as I did, because I really loved it. I feel like it brought some of the like childlike wonder that the original Star Wars movies especially have. Just the very whiz-bang, wow, look at all of this cool stuff. And I think so much of that was because it was from the perspective of these children. And they were very much our audience surrogates, and looking at the galaxy through their eyes, it just brought a really fresh and fun perspective. And it was silly. It was fun. It had great practical makeup for all these different kinds of aliens. It was like a true children's adventure story. And honestly, it may be one of my favorite live action Star Wars shows. Like, I think Andor still takes the top, but weirdly, despite the complete 180 in tone from Andor, this might be my second favorite. I loved just the vibe of it. It felt like original Star Wars, just like so much wonder to it.
I completely agree, especially with that ranking. Like, this is one of the best things they have like put out in recent years. I was so delighted, like, from the moment I started watching it, to realize that this is what this show was. And I like what you're saying, Grace, about how it kind of like feels like old Star Wars in terms of like the childlike wonder. But I also do feel like there was a bit of a risk that they decided to take with this one that made it so successful. Like, someone on Twitter complained, like, suburbs in Star Wars? Like, what is this?
I loved that.
I love the Star Wars suburbs. I personally loved it. The other thing is there was food every episode. There was Star Wars food.
I thought of you every time.
Yes. I was like, this is the show that was made for me. Like it honestly felt like they were meeting all of my demands. So, and I don't, Eric, maybe you can help us understand this. I don't understand why it was so good compared to the other shows. And my working theory is, like, I see Dave Filoni is like the producer on this. I wonder if he's just like naturally a lot better at kids programming. Because it was just, it was perfect, like, it was perfectly done. The pacing, the writing, the, like, the actual moral of the story, it was just, it was all really well done.
I'm curious how much of a role Dave Filoni actually had in the show. I know he's listed as a producer, but I wonder if that just comes from the sort of miscellaneous, like, advice that he would give in his new role at Lucasfilm as kind of the chief creative officer. Like, I'm sure they would go to him and ask him some, like, random Star Wars questions, and I wonder if that's just a credit he gets for having that role within the company. Because I gotta say, I did not detect a lot of Dave Filoni's fingerprints on this show, and depending on how you feel about his most recent work, that might be a good thing or a bad thing, but this was definitely a group of writers and directors who came into it having grown up with the sort of the Amblin Entertainment, you know, Goonies, you know, Steven Spielberg movies, or, you know, just really appreciating the tone of those stories and wanting to just do something like that in Star Wars. And I think it can be very risky when you say, I love X type of movie. What if there was something like that in Star Wars? Because that you're not necessarily starting from the place of like, I have a great story, I want to tell it. It's more like, I love those movies, can I bring that into Star Wars? But in this case, I think it worked because part of what they're really saying that they love is a specific kind of adventure with a specific set of values, a specific set of characters that meshes well with what Star Wars should be, which is young, innocent people fighting for good, virtuous values in a galaxy that is dangerous, where it is easy to become cynical, where it is easy to turn out like Jod, and you have to fight to become Neil instead. That's a challenge just as much as having a dogfight or a lightsaber duel. That idea, which we see in the real world in a lot of these kind of feel-good kid stories, is it's the kids who are bringing a certain youth and a certain naivete, but also just virtuousness, and that gets tested, and they come out on the other side holding on to that. And I think that's what you saw in this story, which is why I liked it so much.
I think that, yes, they were modeling it after movies they clearly loved as kids, like The Goonies being the most obvious analog. But I also think that the original Star Wars movies kind of already fit into that blueprint.
Yes. Like
when we think about the original trilogy, it's of the same era as E.T. It's a little bit before The Goonies, but it is that same era of like these childlike adventures. It's just the difference here is that those movies start adults and this very much is a children's show. But I also, something I really liked, and I'd be interested to get your guys' thoughts on this, is I think a lot of times there's a risk of turning kids, like kid characters, into very two-dimensional or just archetypes, or having them all be the same. And I felt like all of these kids, our four main kids, really did have distinct personalities. And, you know, on the surface, it may seem like, oh, there's the techie girl, there's the like dreamer boy, there's the nice boy, and there's the adventure girl. But I felt like there was a lot of depth to the kids, and I don't know. Did you guys feel that way as well?
Yes. They were so well done. And Neil, like, I don't understand Neil. How they made him so cute and so perfect, but I'm obsessed.
I was going to ask if each of you has a favorite, and maybe you could talk about kind of how you saw them go on a journey throughout the show.
I think kind of what you were saying, I mean, clearly Neil is my favorite. Eric, what you were saying about whether he was going to, like, hold on to his like idealism in the face of like suffering and challenges. I really appreciated that character arc. And I think he did. I thought it was so like, he's just like a wholesome boy.
Yeah, Neil was my favorite, but all of the kids had moments that I loved. So a moment I really loved with KB was, I think it's in episode 6 where, her, like, she's fading and she needs to be retuned. And it's actually a really good non-patronizing lesson about living with a disability. And she says, you know, I can't do things the way that I used to after my accident. And I'm scared of sharing that with Fern. And sort of the lesson of that little arc is not that, oh, disability is something that you have to overcome, but like sometimes you can't do things when you have a disability, and that's okay. And I just really loved that message for kids. And then with Fern, what I really loved for her is in the last episode, I think it is, she has a quote about, we went to some terrible places, but everywhere we went, there were good people that helped us. And I thought that was just such a beautiful message too, of there's a lot of bad places in the world, a lot of bad things you will experience, but everywhere as well, there are also good people who will help you.
Yeah, it's a really sophisticated way to, like, for kids to process this journey that we've seen them go on in terms of, like, they've been to all these places, they've seen a lot. I mean, first of all, their planet is isolated, so it's not like they even had normal space travel to other places. And now they're going on this journey to see the galaxy in this particular way, which is not the easiest way to see the galaxy, but they're able to pick up very astutely on the nuances of galactic civilization, right? The fact that there are people you have to watch out for, but they also noticed that the people out there who were trying to help them, like, they were perceptive enough to not be overwhelmed by the dazzling aliens and the blasters and the factions. They understood, on some level, the kind of interpersonal stuff that they were seeing happen in front of them. They were able to pick up on it and appreciate it, and then come back, and in episode 8, you know, as you talked about, Grace, it's really the kids who teach their parents about the broader galaxy and how to stand up and fight, because that's the episode where, you know, the Jod shows up with the pirates and the parents are kind of at a loss for what to do. And we get to see these kids who were not really prepared to deal with this when they started the show. They were as sheltered as their parents were. In fact, they knew less about what was going on. But now they are able to inspire their parents to stand up because they've seen what the galaxy is like and they've learned a thing or two about values and protecting the innocent and living, being true to who you are and protecting your home. And it's earned. It feels justified that they have that role in the last episode, which is a reversal of sort of the typical parent's child role. That was something else I appreciated.
One thing I want to add, and it's slightly unrelated, but I think really added to the charm of the show for me. We've seen bounty hunters a lot in Star Wars, and we see a couple of them in this, but, like, to have, like, a full pirate culture that looks very similar to, like, real-life pirate culture, yes, from hundreds of years ago, like, even though it's drawing from the past, it actually felt very fresh to me to, like, get to see this in Star Wars. I loved it. I loved that there's, like, a pirate code, that there's this, like, pirate hangout where all the, like, the crazy bad people go in. It's not just, like, a bar. It's like a weird port, like a spaceport. I loved that. And like, of course, I think, you know, the criticism of, is there suburbs in Star Wars? I loved the plot point of, like, this is, like, a lost planet. It's like an El Dorado in space. Like, all of that was just so charming to me. I just thought it was super well done.
Yeah, I can't imagine not wanting to see the suburbs of Star Wars, because we've kind of only gotten the high drama, like, you know, like, super sophisticated politics and super powerful heroes and villains clashing. Like, we've really only seen that side of the galaxy, especially in live action. We have not seen, with the exception of, like, a couple scenes in Andor, of, like, just home life with your mom eating cereal. But other than that, they haven't dwelled on what it's like to be a regular person and to be aware of the fact that there are Jedi out there around you somewhere. I think that's great, and I think it's a good launching point for the story. You don't have to spend the whole show in the suburbs. You can use that as a force that is driving your characters to want more. And when you think about it, Grace, as you said earlier, that's how all of Star Wars starts in 1977. Right. It is Luke on Tatooine wanting more, and now we just happen to see kids wanting more just in a slightly less sandblasted environment, but it's fundamentally the same hero's journey impulse that gets them out into the galaxy.
I mean, Luke basically is a kid of the suburbs, if you think about it. Like, very much just in Tatooine, but, you know, he has a very boring suburban life. It's just a desert planet. And I really loved seeing the interpretation of suburbs in Star Wars. Can we talk about Jod? I really want to talk about Jod. I loved Jod.
Yes, this was not your average Star Wars TV show villain. And I think Jude Law does such a great job playing, like, the side of him that we first meet, and then the twist that we see when he really takes the mask off. Grace, what did you make of the transformation that we see him go through, and all those questions about, is he a Jedi? How does he use the Force? Do you think they paid that off well enough in terms of him? I mean, that's, like, a big thing to do, is drop a guy in a show who has the Force and seems to maybe be a Jedi.
So I loved that he was, like, a fake Jedi, and we find out that it's because he was never trained. But I love that there's just this guy that's kind of bad at using the Force, and he can use it, but he doesn't really usually do so, mostly because he's kind of bad at it. He doesn't really know how to use a lightsaber. And you have to think there are so many people in the galaxy like that who are force sensitive, and it's just part of their daily life that they don't really use. I think that's really fascinating. I loved the character of Jodd. I thought that Jude Law did such a good job. The analog to me as I was watching this show, I don't know if y'all ever read Treasure Island when you were younger, but it was a book that I really loved when I was a kid. And the character of Long John Silver is like this cook on this naval ship who turns out to be a pirate, and he's a real mentor to the 12-year-old main character Jim until he turns out to be a bad guy. And there are times that you think he really cares about Jim and he's going to do the right thing, and the last possible second he chooses not to do the right thing. And obviously, Treasure Island, Hunt for Treasure, there's a big parallel there. But the character of Jodd just really reminded me so much of Long John Silver in Treasure Island. Just this almost mentorish figure who you think could care about the kids, and in a sense does care about the kids as much as he is capable of. He's just been so broken by the world and made so cynical that fundamentally he's not able to make the right decision, and that's why he gets his butt kicked by a bunch of eighth graders.
I'm glad that he didn't have any kind of redemption arc. I think it's kind of a bold decision where, like, I feel like most TV viewers today would like to see like reconciliation at the end or something like that, to have just like he's purely a villain. Maybe it's because I am childlike at heart. Like, I loved seeing just, like, the evil within him. Like, when he's, like, bathing in the gold coins. Like, yes. Yeah. Yes. Put this, like, really upfront message in front of children. I think it's good. Like, you can't both love money and, like, love your neighbor to the full extent that you should. So I thought that that was, like, maybe not the most subtle writing, maybe not the most like complex, like bad guy. Like, I don't care. I actually really enjoyed having a story that had something to say instead of just like, oh, everybody's complex. So I actually appreciated that, like, the evil side of him the most, more so than the like ambiguous, beginning to his story. And I do think what you're saying, Grace, like, it also demonstrates that, like, there's a debate about like nature versus nurture, or like what your decision making power in whether to sort of embrace the greed that Jodd has at a certain point is, like, he sort of describes growing up without having enough, and argues that this is the reason that he is the way he is, but like, he's a grown adult, and at one point he has a knife to a child's throat. and it's like, you don't actually need all of the money in the world. You don't need infinity coins, especially not at the expense of like an actual child's life.
I mean, it's what you were just saying with Neil too. Like, it's about making the choice to be a good person is a lot harder than, you know, being someone who's motivated by money and greed. And so we kind of see that contrast with the kids actively making the choice to be good people, as compared to this grown man who could learn to be better but doesn't,
even though it makes their lives harder. Like they don't have to be good people. And I think it demonstrates the emptiness of the excuses. Like, he makes the excuses, and we as the audience are meant to see how like empty and false that is. He doesn't actually have to act that way. So I don't know. I like appreciated that character for being a clear like message for children, or something for kids to think about. I also like, I don't know. The main thing I appreciated about Jodd is just like the pirate vibes, like beyond the plot points and in the message that I'm talking about. I thought it was fun. Like, I liked pirates in Star Wars.
Yeah, he has a certain flair about him, whether it's before he kind of reveals his true self, but then even afterwards, especially when he, like, one of the things that is great about Jude Law playing him and how he plays him in the show is, you know, there's like those two or three episodes where he's like trying to basically save his neck and convince the pirates like Ad-Atten is real, you know, trust me, I can lead you there. And the way that he kind of wins his position back and like is like convinces the pirates to listen to him, he's got like that great speech at the end of one of the episodes where he shows like he understands his crew in a way that like Brutus the sort of usurper does not. He's like kind of a smooth talker, and there's a certain like flair about him that feels very like true to the pirates who are the inspiration for this character, in terms of like, yes, he's fundamentally bad, like you shouldn't want to emulate him, but there is a certain almost playfulness about his like just eagerness to do the pirate thing. Like his zest for pirating is not like appealing per se, but it's not, he's not like grim about it all the time. Like he definitely has moments, as you said, like putting a knife to Fern's throat. That's not fun and exciting, but the like come follow me to Ad-Atten side of him is very like, there's like an enthusiasm about being a captain and finding the treasure that I think is very authentic to these pirate stories. And again, just like emphasizes that he's not even one-dimensional either. Like the kids are multidimensional, but so is he. He's got his past. He's got his like pretend good guy side. He's got the cruelty, but then he also has like a genuine eagerness for this hidden wealth. And he's, you know, Jude Law is just very good at playing that.
Yeah, like bad guys can be very winsome. They like they can be endearing, you know, but they're still bad guys.
So I don't think we know if this has been renewed for a second season yet. But if it is, I can see Jod coming back, not as an explicit villain, but maybe as just like some weird, ambiguous side character. Like in Pirates of the Caribbean, how Barbossa is the big bad of the first movie and then like comes back in the third movie and is just like a weird ally who's still bad, but just kind of there. Like I could see that as a potential future for Jod and way to bring him back in.
I don't want to see. I think it was such a good like closed story. I don't want more of it. That's my hot take. I thought it was so well done. They don't need to do any more Skeleton Crew.
Yeah, it's interesting because they very pointedly don't show Jod dying, which I guess is probably more than they would want to do on a kid's show, but it almost felt deliberate, like they were leaving the door open, like they thought they'd get to come back. And I agree with you, Haley. I think this in particular, out of like all the shows, was best as one season. We got, I think, what we wanted from these kids. I don't see them becoming like a team that goes out into the galaxy to do, like, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't feel like the first season of like a superhero team up show.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine what the good story would be. But of course, like, they did a good job coming up with the first season story. So maybe they'll do a great job if they do another one. I just personally, like, given the track record, we don't need to turn this into like a thing, in my opinion. It was a good story and we can enjoy it.
I do want to see Neil get back together with his girlfriend though on the French resistance planet. Was good.
But let's crush, what about his crush back at home, Eric?
You know what's funny girl. That they never come back to that. I really thought there'd be some moment in the finale where like he does something heroic and she sees it and he's just like brushes off his shoulders and it's like, yeah, I'm different now. Something like that. Like I thought that would be really funny, but they just never came back to it. But actually, that's a great jumping off point to something that I wanted to focus on, because we've talked about some of the things that are funny in this show, but I really do think that this is the funniest Star Wars show, that it has the best humor, it has like the cleverest humor, it's the most like realistic, like kind of down-to-earth humor. A lot of Star Wars just can't operate on the level of like lives that you and I would be able to understand, because we're not Jedi and we're not fighter pilots. I mean, there are fighter pilots out there, but they're not going to blow up moon-sized space station, so a lot of it is just not accessible to us. But a lot of what we see, especially from the kids, is like you can understand and appreciate that humor more because it's connected to like real experiences that you might have experienced yourself. Like a lot of the, like, there's a scene where Neil is like talking to Wim and he's like,
I didn't even ask how assessment went. How did assessment go?
I think good.
Okay, that's great. Let's go.
Just little, like, kind of human moments like that where it's not, there's nothing alien or, like, spacey about that humor. It's not like, oh, you're strong enough to pull the arms off a Gundark, you know, like Han says in The Empire Strikes Back. Like, that's, you know, that's just, like, kind of a hard line to wrap your head around if it's supposed to be funny. But all of this is just, like, real experiences that you could imagine yourself going through, and or maybe you have. And so I thought that, like, it was important to point that out because it's, I think, the glue that holds the show together in a lot of ways. Like, this journey that they go on is not fulfilling if the kids aren't having a fun time, if they're not really leaning into the adventure, and so much of them leaning in is the humor. So I just wanted to shout that out. I don't know if you guys have, like, favorite funny moments, but...
You're right, Eric. And it's not, like, Avengers funny, like, quippy lines. Like, it's, like, actually funny in the context. My very favorite, I love Wim and his father, his strange absent father. I love the, like, when they're back and the robot is watching them and they use their suburb space Star Wars microwave to make the food. And he goes,
Nothing like a home-cooked meal.
And yep. It's like a TV dinner. It was just, he said it so earnestly.
I really love, well, first of all, I really loved the robot who I can't remember his name right now.
33.
33. I loved him. I thought he was very funny. But I really loved the planet they went to where the dead captain's like treasure hoard was stored. And like it apparently used to be a really rough and tumble planet and now it's an elite spa. I thought that was a really fun joke. And then all of the sort of details of the spa were really funny. And then I also loved when Fern made friends with like the giant squid monster alien by telling it stories in the spa. Like it was just, there were lots of good also visual gags, I think, and just
33 on that, well, it's related, 33 on that spa planet. I had to rewatch it because it was so funny. They put this like restraining bolt on him and they say, this will stop you from being violent. And instantly he like tries to choke the person who says that. And he's like, does it? And it like it stops him from doing it. I was cackling. It was
that
so
whole
funny.
Planet was so good. I just love they gentrified Skull Ridge Mountain. Like I love seeing in Star Wars, like, you know, there's these places from the distant past of the galaxy that how many times have we like heard about or been to one of these places where it's like still that exotic Star Wars-y planet. And yet in this one, they just go full head on into like, nope, they like decided to turn this into a spa planet. They didn't like, they didn't leave this planet as this like wasteland for whatever reason. They realized like, oh, we could turn this into something productive and useful. And here is like SM-33 from an earlier age being like, the galaxy has left me behind. I can't have my deadly pirate hangout anymore. They have to make it into a luxury spa. I just think that concept of like taking the past of Star Wars that our characters are like, you know, talking about as this mysterious deadly past and like just completely like neutering it and defanging it and just making it completely like, what's the planet? A Canto Bight from yes. The Last Jedi. Just like the idea that, of course, you would not just want to leave these places to rot in their like mysterious deadliness. You would want to like reclaim them to some degree. And I just love SM-33 being like, oh, where do you even torture someone here? This is terrible.
His voice was so well done, by the way. Like, I don't know if I've seen a robot so sold, like in on the, like, whatever he is serving. He became a pirate as a robot. And I, yes. Like, I love that. The other, like, bit that I loved from SM-33 is the can't say I remember no at Atten. Like, he said it so many times, and every time he said it after the first time, I thought it was hilarious. I don't know if I'm just, like, a child, but I thought it was hilarious every time.
Well, and then, of course, it has the payoff, whereas it's like he's saying that for a reason.
Right.
What were the other... I guess... So, okay, so my two other favorite moments were when Jod is, like, trying to find SM-33 back on the pirate hangout planet, he comes across a battle droid, and he turns the battle droid on, and immediately, without missing a beat, the battle droid's first question is, did we win?
Yes!
That was great. And then, you know, talking about, like, the kids and the way that they have humor together being so realistic and like not missing a beat, like perfect delivery, excellent writing. There's a moment where they're trying to figure out if Jod is a Jedi, and Fern says to Wim,
"There's a million ways to make it look like something is floating. Name one. Repulsor lift, tractor beam, magnets, mirrors. String. String. Like a really thin string."
Just like completely without missing a beat. Just that was so funny.
It was. I also, there's a moment when they're trying to find like 33 after the pirates put them in jail. And Jod is going back to get him. I think Neil is like,
"Oh, and don't forget about the rat that lives in his eye hole."
Like, caring for the rat. Like, I love that. It's the Spider-Man crew, Eric. This is why it's so good.
I'm trying to remember that movie, or those movies. I don't know if they did them all, but
it's the Tom Holland ones.
Yes, I do remember liking them. I don't remember being like bowled over by the humor in them.
I didn't know they were this. Yeah, they weren't this funny. Like, I'm kind of surprised by this.
All right, well, I want to talk about one of the sort of hidden, wonderful surprises of Skeleton Crew, which is At Aten and this concept of the jewels of the Old Republic and really the central mystery in the show. I thought it was really exciting how Skeleton Crew had, on the one hand, these great characters and, you know, we see them go on this fun journey, but at the same time, they're really building out a corner of the Star Wars mythos that we've never seen explored before, which is the idea of these, as I said, the jewels of the Old Republic, which we find out are at least At Aten is a mint planet where they make credits, and it has been hidden behind an impenetrable barrier, which has two very interesting consequences. One is it has become the stuff of legend. It's a planet that's sort of lost in the galaxy. But the other thing is the people on the planet are lost in time. They don't know what's going on in the outside galaxy. They're still kind of living as if they're citizens of the Old Republic. And that means that when the kids get out there, it's a culture shock in a lot of ways. But one of them is they are just completely unprepared for the greater galaxy. I'm really interested to hear what the two of you have to say about kind of what this brings to Star Wars, to know that there were these hidden planets and that it's possible to build this barrier around one of them and basically keep everything in the galaxy from getting in, but also keep that society from finding out about the galaxy. I think you guys can tell, I think this is a fascinating concept. But Grace, what did you think of At Aten?
I really loved the vibes of At Aten, as we already talked about, the sort of suburbia of it. I really enjoyed the sort of mini twist that the supervisor was a droid. I thought it was interesting how everyone's lives were very prescribed and, you know, you would have to determine how your entire life would go from a test that you took when you were 13. That all felt like very real and fun to me. But honestly, the sort of mystery of At Aten was the weakest part of the show for me. I thought it was interesting to see, you know, this vestige of the Old Republic, but at the same time, I also felt like maybe the adults had bought into the great work to a degree that wasn't necessarily plausible to me. Like, if no one has come to pick up the credits in 40 years, then shouldn't that be a sign that something is happening outside in the galaxy that you need to know about? So that bit of it kind of strained credulity for me. But I did like the idea of these hidden planets and the other hidden planets that were scattered about, as Haley talked about earlier, with the sort of pirates looking for these hidden planets was really fun. And again, was very much like Treasure Island, Treasure Planet-y to me of, you know, looking for a hidden trove of treasure that I really like that element of it.
I think that's a fair complaint, Grace, about like the parents maybe should have noticed sooner that like that they, first of all, that they were, nobody was coming to get the credits, but also like completely lacking any curiosity about what was out there. But I also feel like it's the only way the story really made sense. And I personally love the idea of the children like teaching their parents a lesson about being independent and asking questions and being curious and being willing to have an adventure, even if it's not always safe. So even if it's a little bit silly, I still love it. I know one of Eric's gripes about this show is one of those like silly moments. We might get to that in a moment, but that I also loved even though it's childish.
I think for me, it's true, obviously, that you should, if you have critical thinking skills, be wondering what's going on when there hasn't been a pickup in 40 years. On the other hand, I think what we see here is a society that has kind of given up on critical thinking to a large degree. They trust the supervisor to make decisions for them. It's unclear how many people even know that the supervisor is a droid. That scene where they arrive with Jod and Undersecretary Farah kind of brings them to see the supervisor, I think it's implied that she knew that beforehand because she says, you know, yeah, this was as decreed by the great work, but it's...
Do all of them know it?
Yeah, so that's the question, right? So how many other people know who they're even listening to here? And if they don't know, that's almost more dystopian. I mean, I like the way that they sort of lump all this together under the term great work. That's like the catch-all for like the project of AT-ATN. And on the one hand, I think it's interesting because that's a term from the High Republic books, which is basically a reference to like a mega project that the Republic undertakes to show its strength, but also to kind of as like a public diplomacy project. You know, they build these big space stations and they build hyperspace buoys to connect people's communications. It's basically a way of saying we are the galactic government and we have the strength to do this. And so that got me wondering, could the whole Jewels of the Old Republic project, you know, hiding these planets behind barriers and setting them up to serve some important purpose, could that have been basically a mega project at some point in the past? We don't know when it was created. We just know that it was created during the Republic. But to me, it's this the duality of these planets. On the one hand, they are evidence of a massive amount of expenditure and technical genius and just like planning capacity, which is cool. But on the other hand, the societies themselves are very anemic. It's almost like they only exist to serve this purpose as a mint or whatever the others are. The people who live there, they don't have that thriving life that you would expect. You know, it's peaceful and serene on the surface, but below that, as I said, there's not a lot of critical thinking going on.
Yeah, I think that would be my complaint, is great work implies some kind of like aspect of it that is fulfilling. And instead they're like systems analysts and they're just making money. and if anything is, you know, hard to believe for me, it's that like people would not be looking for more. And that only Wim is the only person on the planet thinking about, you know, what's happening beyond that planet. Which of course there could be other people, but it's kind of implied, at least among the adults, that they're just kind of living their lives.
Yeah, and I think part of that comes down to Wim being the only one of the characters that we see who is reading stories of the Jedi. I mean, presumably there are other kids on this planet who have this yearning for adventure, but the characters that we meet, only one of them seems to feel that way, and it's because he is reading about what's happening out there or what he thinks is still happening out there. Obviously, it's over now, but he believes that that is what he will find out in the galaxy, and so that's the attitude that he takes with them. And you kind of get the sense that if these adults were just as, like, if they still read the stories of the great Jedi, maybe they would be inspired to, like, be more curious about what's happening beyond the barrier, essentially. But they're, you know, they're adults, they've got their drudgery jobs. Like, this is one of those ways where a skeleton crew dips into kind of real world adventure storytelling. The adults are never the ones who are pushing the boundaries and yearning for more, because they are settled into their adult lives, and it's the kids who have the flexibility and the imagination and the room to kind of want more.
Yeah, I think that's actually sort of to counter my complaint. I think that's actually probably the purpose of it, is that fundamentally this is a kid's story with kid protagonists. And like Haley was saying earlier, it's about them actually teaching their parents lessons. So while, you know, for me as an adult watching this, it's kind of like, oh, come on, how come these dumb adults haven't noticed anything? From the perspective of a kid watching it, it's like, of course, that makes sense. Kids are the ones who notice things, and sometimes adults don't notice things, and they've lost their sense of whimsy and ability to dream about the galaxy beyond. So I think narratively it makes sense. It's just a complaint I had with it, that it's not like exactly a plot hole, but is something that, you know, like doesn't make sense in world necessarily, but makes sense on a meta level. And that actually does bring me to something that I think Haley and I disagree with Eric on, which is that I really liked Claimsies and Unclaimsies, and I liked the return of Claimsies and Unclaimsies, and how this droid 33 was just willing to follow along those rules. It kind of is fitting with that sort of idea that this is fundamentally a kid's story, and it's about kids figuring things out and outwitting adults. And it's kind of hilarious to me that Claimsies and Unclaimsies would be part of this sort of pirate code and able to be sort of validated by a pirate droid.
Yeah, I think that's a great example of like me feeling the way that you feel about AT-AT, where there's an obvious story reason for why this had to happen this way, and it fits with the kind of whimsical nature of a kid-driven story. But if you kind of scratch under the surface and look at it in universe, it's unclear why there's a pirate rule where you can only have one ship at a time. I mean, pirate captains that command fleets are nominally in charge of a lot of ships at any one time. So that, like, where did that rule come from? Why does that rule exist? And also, why would the idea of, like, unclaimsies, which is not something that we have heard about in the pirate code, even from SM-33, why would he just all of a sudden be like, you know what? Actually, I'm going to go along with that, because I like it. Like, he's a droid. He's supposed to be following rules. I guess you could say he's an old droid. He's eccentric. His systems are on the fritz. He'll just randomly decide to go with the flow sometimes. Like, that's the best excuse I can come up with, because Unclaimsies, as far as I know, is not part of the pirate code that we hear about from SM-33 until it's, like, necessary for the story.
I'm defending SM-33. I think he has full moral agency and just chose to side with the children, and he does not serve anyone except whatever he decides to do when he's not, like, fritzing out. Like, in that moment, it's just like, yeah, I want the kids to succeed. And he, like, sides with them. That's my opinion. It would explain why he's, like, so, like, he's truly a pirate. Like, I don't think he has to really take orders unless he wants to.
Yeah, but then on the Skullridge Mountain planet, when Jod betrays them, he gets SM-33 to work for him, even when SM-33 clearly doesn't want to, and he's like, I'm sorry, Fern, he's the captain now. So they're kind of inconsistent with how they portray his, like, obedience to rules.
I don't know, like, maybe, I honestly think that, like, maybe 33 had a moment of greed, and, like, he was just going along with it for a moment. I don't know if he actually was bound by anything. That's why I'm okay with, like, letting it be inconsistent, because people are inconsistent, and I've decided 33 is a person.
By the way, speaking of greed, we were talking before about how it's cool to see Jod kind of go on this pirate quest, and it's fun how they kind of let him just, like, luxuriate in all the credits when he finally gets to the vault. But I have to say, I can't be the only one who just wanted to reach through my TV and explain the concept of inflation to Jod, because if he just starts printing out new credits, all that money is suddenly going to be worth a lot less. And I feel like long-term pirate thinking here, he should not want the currency to be devalued. Was anybody else surprised that this kid show didn't explore monetary policy in more detail, or am I the only one?
You know what? They should have learned from that beloved smash hit, The Phantom Menace, basically a kid's movie that talked a lot about trade policy and finances, and they should have just done more of that, because clearly what made The Phantom Menace such a beloved hit is the trade policy. So they really should have talked to Jod about the inflation, and maybe the kids could have explained inflation to him too, as yet another, like, kids rock moment.
Yeah, how are they not learning about inflation in their classes, which I have to assume were all, like, low-key preparing them to be, like, financial analysts? I just assume that that whole plan is geared toward making credits and managing credits. So presumably they took classes on economics, but maybe they're too young for that at this point. I don't know.
It seemed like they were doing really, complex math.
That is actually a really fun trope for me in, like, sci-fi fantasy stories where they, like, the way that they show that we're in the future is that the really young people are, like, learning things that in real life they would not be able to understand yet. Like, just, like, you're supposed to watch it and go, like, oh, man, in the future, seven-year-olds will understand calculus. Like, that makes me feel so stupid. And I like that they kind of maintain that here with a rare look at education in Star Wars, and it seems like they're maintaining that trope from sci-fi. So I guess as we move towards the end here, I did want to talk very briefly about the New Republic, because this is one of the very few live action stories so far that we've seen in this era. And for the most part, the other stuff like Mando and Book of Boba Fett and Ahsoka, the New Republic is portrayed as pretty feckless in those shows. And here we actually get the New Republic being the genuine heroes. The last episode calls them, you know, the real good guys. And I think it's, For me, anyway, it's kind of refreshing to see, especially through the kids' eyes, what the New Republic can do when it has its act together. When it sends ships and sends enough ships and gets them there quickly enough, it can actually do its job, which at this point, you know, pre-First Order, the New Republic is primarily in a security role, you know, dealing with pirates. And so here we see a quintessential example of the anti-piracy work that is supposed to be the New Republic's bread and butter. So I just appreciated, as somebody who, like, feels like the New Republic is the scrappy underdog of, like, storytelling a little bit because it's constantly made fun of, I did like seeing them succeed and actually be the heroes coming to the rescue. But I don't know how you guys feel about, you know, how we see the New Republic in the show.
I agree. I like an earnest good guy at the end, yes. But I did worry that, like, adding them to the New Republic means that their planet is gonna get blown up by the end of episode 7. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, I think if you're the First Order, you would want to go at least take over or destroy the Mint Planet, if they still use it at that point. We don't know.
Like, when they destroy that whole system with the I'm forgetting the name of the planet that's a Death Star, I don't understand. Is that the whole New Republic, Eric, that they destroyed?
No, it's just the rotating capital planet and maybe some of its moons, but it's not like all the planets that are in the New Republic.
Oh, okay, that makes me feel better. I was like, these poor kids just, like, opened up their planet to getting destroyed by Hux.
No, I think they're all still alive, although I do wonder if Wim, after seeing the New Republic come to the rescue, is going to join the military and perhaps be on Hosnian Prime when it's blown up. So I hope that doesn't happen, but we'll probably never know.
Bummer.
Yeah. Okay, so I think, you know, closing out here, I want to just, like, get your thoughts on anything we didn't discuss that you want to either praise or criticize. We had a little bit of a discussion about unclaimsies earlier where I don't want to be the Debbie Downer, like, criticizing the show too much, but there were a few things like that and, like, the pirates just being terrible shots in the last episode. And how did Jod get on the Onyx Cinder ship when he was, like, left behind? And, like, just a lot of little things like that where I'm like, this is clearly only happening because they need to move the story forward, but it is not good writing. It is not, like, they didn't think this through very carefully. But was there anything that, like, bothered you about that? Maybe we can do, like, a compliment sandwich, like, complaints, and then we'll wrap up with, like, anything that we want to be, like, especially complimentary of.
I kind of feel like we kind of already compliment sandwiched, or at least us talking about our, maybe meta-narrative issues that we understand why they had to be. So I don't know if we need to sort of go through that further.
That's fair. I think, you know, looking at the show in totality, it is clear that they found an interesting fresh premise and they were able to, like, combine what I thought was pretty good character development with good, like, lore, for lack of a better term, kind of making the galaxy feel bigger. And packing in a lot of, as we said, like, great aliens. I think we talked at the beginning, like, there's a ton of great aliens in the show. great visuals, really cool planets that are different than just Tatooine for the 15th time. And, you know, as we talked about as well, a lot of great humor. And I think that the total package here is a show that feels different. It feels different, and it also feels worthwhile. You're not going to watch this and go, why did they make this? The purpose here, the message that they're trying to send is, like, very clear. And I think overall, they stuck the landing. That's, like, kind of, that's my big picture here. Do you guys want to, like, offer any big picture takeaways on Skeleton Crew?
It's very good. I'm excited. By the end of it, I was really excited to watch it with my kids when they're a little bit older, which I cannot say of all of the Star Wars shows. I can say it really only of, like, this one and Rebels, and I guess Clone Wars. But when I was a kid, even that was a little bit scary, so I'm not in the headspace to think about showing that one to my kids yet. But this one, absolutely. I almost was like, my kid is, like, Lewis is almost ready for this show. I mean, it's a little scary. There's some violence, but, like, he loves pirates. So, I don't know. It brought me joy. It will bring my children joy as well.
Yeah, I thought it was just a really lovely show. Like I said at the top, it might be my second favorite of the live action Star Wars shows. It was just a delight from start to finish. And, like, yeah, I had some quibbles, but it felt like fun kid Star Wars. And I was thinking, you know, I probably would have loved this when I was a kid, as I was watching it, and it kind of made me feel like a kid again. So I really thought it was great, and I thought it added a lot of fun texture to the galaxy. It's also the first thing set in the New Republic era that hasn't completely annoyed me, because I am often frustrated by New Republic era stories, but maybe that's because the New Republic was really kind of a background character, and not the politics were not at the forefront. But yeah, I thought it was great, and it was really fun to watch a Star Wars show and be like, wow, I enjoy Star Wars again, because it feels like it's kind of been a while since I've had that for me.
All right, that's going to do it for our look back at Skeleton Crew. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode or suggest topics for future shows, you can email us at hothtakes@gmail.com, or you can find us on X or Blue Sky. We are at hothtakes. I am at Eric Geller on X. Grace is Grace_Seegers, and Haley is Burdenator. Haley made our logo and banner art, and I edited this episode and put together our music. Although, for legal purposes, we want to remind you that all Star Wars music and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website, that's hothtakes.wordpress.com. And if you like the show, please share it with a friend. You can find Hoth Takes on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Spotify. We'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.